Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the Toy Department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, Saturday Toy Department time, everybody.
Hey.
I'm Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky. I got the draft on in the background here. We're just sort of chit-chatting about
it.
Did you enjoy the draft this year? We've got a lot of stuff to talk about, so don't worry. We're not going to linger very long on this. But did you enjoy the draft this year as an entertainment product?
I think I kind of did. I'm not going to tell you I watched all of it, but
No one does, right? You can't.
Right. But kind of, I have some criticisms. I have some advice for if this was to be done again. Like right now I'm looking at Roger Goodell in a t-shirt that says a lifetime of Sundays sitting in a leather chair among many books and mahogany bookshelves. And I don't need that on my TV. But, you know, so like I would have changed some things, but it was interesting. I don't know if it was great TV, but it was interesting.
Yeah, I think it was interesting at times. I mean, look, you know, it's hard. Some of the content is interesting, right? So it's, as long as you're showing that content,
right. Way too you know, much that takes care of itself. General.
But yeah, I thought it was way too much Goodell and man, they just. I felt like it was just larded with NFL propaganda. You know what I mean?
Well, but that's, I mean, that's what it is.
Yeah. I don't know. Can we, you got Goodell, you've got all these technical challenges. I don't understand why they didn't use a more entertaining host and kind of,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
I think that's the easiest criticism is just put somebody funny in there. In fact, we did a bit on the show yesterday about like, you know, call in your suggestions, you know. Ray Ratto suggested Hannibal Buress, which is an odd but I think delightful suggestion. befitting Ray Ratto. But I can't
imagine the NFL letting that happen under any circumstances.
No, of course not. Most of the people that were suggested, but like even, I mean, one of the goofy suggestions was have The Rock and Terry Crews do it. And as goofy as that is, like it would have been better.
Yeah. And the thing is, I think The Rock would have been just as big an NFL shill as like Trey Wingo
Totally. And you don't have to get rid of Trey Wingo, but like, give me some spice. Give me some spice on the front end, at least, you know?
Yeah.
I definitely
felt like it needed some spice.
And just less Goodell. Much less Goodell. And one of my other major criticisms was, and maybe I'm just overly sensitive to this because of the situation, but it felt like they went out of their way to lean into sad storylines with as many draft picks as possible.
Oh, well, were you watching on ABC?
I was watching on ESPN.
Oh, you were? Okay. Because they, you know, the ABC, they did an ABC draft that was hosted by Tom Rinaldi, and I feel like that says what you need to say in that regard. And a lot of people watched that and thought it was the only draft and were like, why were they so heavy on backstory? And Simmons was like that, I noticed.
Are you sure?
I watched the ESPN one, and that was the one hosted by Wingo.
Uh-huh. That's what I watched, and I felt like almost every pick, there was a story about a relative passing away, somebody in the family who's sick, I imagine most people have some sadness in their lives if you look for it.
So, yeah, and there were some pretty exceptional ones, though. Like the one who's like dad died saving him from drowning,
no,
and then his
course.
Brother got hit by lightning.
Of like, course.
I don't mean to laugh at that. It was
no,
just like,
and
whoa.
I'm not trying to minimize anyone's suffering, but I don't know if I was the draft pick, I wouldn't want that to be the thing we focused on a positive life-changing day for me. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it just felt weird. Like, and sure, some of the more remarkable ones, like, you kind of can't help but tell that story, but it felt like they did it a lot.
Yeah, maybe you're right. We should probably move on from this.
Yeah,
I'll just leave on this
Lamb
point.
CeeDee Lamb is wearing this chain for his childhood friend who died. Like, oh my god.
I feel like with all that, they really missed out on the singular story of the night, which is Cliff Kingsbury's house.
Correct.
I mean,
did you see the tweet? I forget who it was, but somebody tweeted that pretty cool that Cliff Kingsbury lives in the Parasite house, provided there's not like a family living in his basement.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I heard someone say, oh, this has definitely been used in a genre of film that's 18 and over.
Yeah,
which definitely had that vibe for sure.
Yeah, I don't know how active that industry is in the Arizona desert, but if that was in the Inland Empire, guaranteed.
Yeah. But what a house. Like, that was like, you know,
well, and
that's
also
the one you want for Coachella.
Totally.
That house right there.
And the lesson here is like, I think actually Damon Bruce on my radio show put it the best. It's like, the first thing you see when you get outside the Bay Area is square footage.
Yeah. That's,
like, your money, your money goes a long way in Arizona, my friend.
All right. Let's quickly move on to our other sports subject of the day, which is the ESPN documentary, The Last Dance. I want to start with you because you are a Chicago Bulls fan. In general.
I don't know if that makes me better or worse to start with, because this is my childhood. Like, I probably have more childhood memories from watching this team live than any other single thing. I remember more Bulls games sitting in either Chicago Stadium or the United Center than I remember my own soccer games or baseball games.
Yeah.
Or, like, this is my childhood on the screen in front of me. Very little of this is news to me per se, but there's so much I hadn't remembered or thought about in 20 years.
Right. And that's part of it too, is like, yeah, it's like, maybe you know some of these beats already. Maybe some of them you forgot.
Well, and, you know, a couple.
But it's just nice to see him again, even if you did remember. You know
what
I mean?
And, like, being around some sub-millennials, you know, the producers at my radio station who work on my show are both 25 and under, I want to say.
Gen Z?
Whatever they're called.
What are they called?
Don't know any of this. Yeah. This is like an education for them, you know? And I just thought it was so well done. And for me, it was really like reliving the most cherished moments of my youth.
Yeah. Any, images that like stood out to you as like,
well, the first thing that stood out is just my impotent and furious rage at Jerry Krause's back in full force.
Mm. That was the one thing.
Particularly impotent now that he has passed away.
Yeah, I feel like it was a little unfair to crush him in the way that, just in that he wasn't really around to speak for himself. And I particularly feel that way about, you know, Reinsdorf's contributions, because Reinsdorf never seemed to have any issue with throwing Krause under the bus. And there's a whole like, well, wait, weren't you part of this? Like,
not
this guy didn't single-handedly decide to break up the team, right? You were there for all of that, right? Why didn't you step in the way?
Well, right. Okay, so here's how I see this. And this is not a defense of Jerry Reinsdorf. But it is an explanation, I think, of how he, generally speaking, does business. He hires a guy who he believes in as a manager, personnel control guy, and also likes as a person for some strange reason. Usually a guy that not necessarily many teams would hire. Reinsdorf or Krause is an obvious one. But even Paxson and Gar Foreman, and Kenny Williams. Virtually all of his personnel control management people, he hires them because he likes something specific about them, and then empowers them and sort of usually washes his hands of the whole deal for a long time, you know? And especially if that person wins, you know, the equity Kenny Williams got from the 2005 World Series win, I believe he's still, like, somewhere at the top of the organization.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a long fallow period between 2005 and the rebuild that's only now just succeeding. A long fallow period. Enough to turn off the limited fan base you had. But Jerry Reinsdorf sort of maintains this plausible deniability by being like, oh, I trust Kenny and Kenny's in charge. And now it's, you know, Kenny's right-hand man, Rick Hahn, is the actual GM. Same thing with Paxson. Same thing with Krause at the time. The problem is, it's one thing to do that when you're like wallowing in mediocrity like the Bulls did with the Heinrich and Gordon teams and sort of having some peaks with Thibodeau and Rose and some valleys afterward. You know what I'm saying? Like, when you're up and down, it's one thing to say that. When you are watching your general manager that you've empowered and stepped away from dismantle the greatest dynasty in the history of the sport, like, at some point, you got to step in or you're not doing the right thing.
Right.
And
right,
so
exactly.
For him to sort of be like, well, you know, that was really just Krause's deal until the very last moment when I stepped in to get one more year with Jackson. But by that point, it was too the whole thing was too ruined to actually salvage it for any long term. You know, you're ignoring the fact that you could have you waited to step in until the point where you could only get one more year out of it. If you'd stepped in a year earlier or simply fired Jerry Krause, you know, everything could be different. But that said, Krause is the guy who, like, although Reinsdorf backed him, and that is not just questionable, but stupid, Krause is the guy whose ego and bitterness and desire to be one of the cool kids and desire for credit torpedoed the whole thing. Because if Phil Jackson could get Michael Jordan and Dennis Rodman and Scottie Pippen and a whole team of players to buy in and pull the rope the same direction and succeed, like, it's deeply offensive to me that the Crumbs, the GM, couldn't just hop on board at that point.
Yeah, but see, that's what I mean. Like, Crumbs, the GM. Like, I just think there's probably a Jerry Krause version of this story. You know what I mean? And that he certainly was not the only one with an ego and desire for credit in the midst of this situation.
Well, but the other guys were getting it.
But
and that's
let's,
the issue. The other guys got the credit. And that, you know, that's where the issue comes from. All that being said, I think what the document people to me ignore when it, and look, this does crush Jerry Krause, and I don't think that's that shocking given that really you have to assume Michael Jordan is the hand,
right? It's his point of view,
it's his documentary, but it also points out that Jerry Krause made some really savvy moves to put this team together, and Jerry Krause really did. Jerry Krause hired Phil Jackson,
right? Yeah, he should get some credit for that. For
and
sure.
and for me, he does, but that doesn't excuse what you did at the end. It just doesn't. Right. And I'm sorry, like, you as a, if you want to be a great general manager, you have to be able to say, you know what? Let them not know, but I'll know that I put together the greatest dynasty of all time. And
yeah,
then
I agree.
I won't be known as the guy who deliberately destroyed the greatest dynasty of all time. You know, he had that choice and he chose wrong.
All right. A couple of images that jumped out at me. The Chicago Stadium in the pre, like in Jordan's first season and in the shots that they had in the, you know, of the team before he arrived.
Yep.
Like, just seeing how empty it was, was kind of stark to me. And I was like, oh, I didn't realize things were quite that fallow before he got there.
Oh, yeah.
That was wild. I'm sure
traveling cocaine circus.
The traveling cocaine circus was great. I am sure that given that you do a radio show with an Indiana grad, you probably talked about Bobby Knight's observation in 84. And loath as I am to give that man credit, because I just think he's a despicable human being.
He's pretty. He's pretty.
Can't deny the basketball acumen. You know, tremendous. And that quote was something, was real, you know what I mean? To call that out at that particular point when the man had not bounced a basketball in the NBA.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
And he says it so matter-of-factly.
Yeah.
He's just like, he's great at this and this, which in my mind makes him the greatest basketball player I've ever seen. And you're like, what? Just like that?
Yeah, it's like you coached Isaiah Thomas like 5 years before that. You know what I mean? So
you've coached, and this is at a point where he's at the top of the coaching game in college.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
I mean, he's coached tons of incredible stars, college stars certainly, but even as you mentioned, a pro Hall of Famer like Isaiah Thomas.
Right.
So that's that was one of the most. I agree that stood out as much as anything in the first two episodes. And I was going to say, Bobby is pretty much out of it at this point. But we did get him to call into the show for Damon's birthday.
Oh, really? Wow. Yeah.
So I have recently spoken to Bobby Knight. Although I didn't even really talk. We just let Damon do it.
Yeah, that's did Damon have tears in his eyes?
Well, we weren't in the same place, but he was as taken aback and challenged for words as I've ever heard him. He like took a basketball class that Bobby Knight taught when he was at Indiana, like, you know, it was a whole thing.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine. All right, let's jump over to the challenge. I had this observation that Jordan from the challenge is similar to Michael Jordan in a way.
Ha!
Not
personality-wise.
Right, not in that he's the greatest, you know, obviously the greatest challenge player, although there's an argument.
But he's certainly not obviously the greatest challenge player.
Right. But the thing that makes him a great challenge player, and I think this is where he's similar to Michael, is also the thing that kind of makes him an insufferable dick.
Yes.
Right? And yeah, so Jordan didn't figure all that prominently in this episode, but that connection did occur to me.
He had a couple of ITM lines where he was just like, this is the diabolical thing that I am doing, and this is why I am doing it. Can't you idiots see this?
Yeah, which is great.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Yeah. This was though, an episode all about Ashley, right? I mean, this was Ashley's episode, and she grabbed it, and she did her thing, and she didn't let the door hit her on her way out.
Yeah, she hit the high note and walked off the stage. Although, I got to say, and I felt this way for a while, but this episode really brought it home for me. I really enjoy Maddie.
Yes.
I really feel like she brings a lot to the table. And you would have thought the two of them would make a pretty good pair because they're a certain kind of Southern woman. Mm-hmm. You know, and
Maddie is is more straightforward, though.
Yep.
And that's kind of what's funny about her. She surprises you sometimes because she turns into like she pulls a little Ashley out of the back pocket every now and then, it seems like.
Yeah. And it was like basically when those two went at it after the fire extinguisher thing, it was basically amazing. Like Ashley on Ashley violence.
Yes.
And it was that was an incredible 4 or 5 minutes of television.
It sure was. And like, why are they fighting? There was no reason that the two of them, of all the people in the room, should have been yelling at each other.
Well, the answer, I think, boils down to, and I actually needed a second viewing to fully comprehend this, they're all blackout drunk, right? Like,
oh, totally.
That was the reason that all of this happened.
Yeah, for right? sure. Well, and because Bear made it happen.
Right, but Bear, like, I actually rewind this, like, the Zapruder film, because they're in there having that conversation. The two of them are totally shit house.
Yeah.
And there's one point where he leans in for a hug, and she actually kind of looks up like she's ready for the kiss. And I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, that's – they're drunk. And then that was everything that led to the fire extinguisher and all the rest of it. Yeah.
Bear – we can't lose. Bear is precious to this show at this point.
Yeah, sure is.
Like, he's just – he's a catalyst for so much. Like, I mean this in the most analytical way, like, whether he's doing it deliberately or not, and he often is, but he's just like, he's a lightning rod for the kind of stuff that makes the Challenge House part of it great. And he also is a solid competitor. And like, man, I without him, you're really struggling. Like, this, I feel like this season right now is really at a tipping point talent wise.
Oh, interesting. Because I get what you're saying. And by the way, let me just say catalyst is the perfect word. Like, for Bear, he literally is like the thing that you drop in the solution to make
right.
it just
exactly.
melt all over the place. I sort of feel like it's a deep enough cast that there are a lot of interesting people who we just haven't heard all that much from who could sort of theoretically step up. Like, you know, there were a couple of Kyle comments out of nowhere where you're just like, oh yeah, Kyle's been sort of
right.
laying in the weeds this whole show. You know what I mean?
But that's his preferred style. The thing about Kyle is like, man, I just feel like you've got the Johnny Bananas and Wes thing going right now. And that was great this week, especially because Ashley lost it on Wes for no reason.
Yeah.
But, boy, other than that and Bear, I feel like it could get kind of weird kind of fast.
Yeah, but see, well, Jordan's another one, though. How much trouble
right.
has he started? You know what I mean?
You're
like,
right.
it's,
you're right. It's
it'll
a
be
deep
fine
bench.
As it gets
it
more
is a
serious.
Deep bench.
Yeah, you know. You know, Nani has been relatively quiet. We heard a little bit in the first episode, and then
well, she almost got in a fight over the fire extinguisher too.
Yes, she did. It was great. All right. So I don't know if this was like my favorite episode of the year.
Well, here's what I think: the challenge and elimination were the weakest part of this episode.
Yeah. Although I will say, I think this was maybe the challenge where I have the most felt like, oh, these people might be in actual danger.
Totally.
Like, it usually seems like a pretty protected situation.
Right. No, this seems super dangerous, especially when you realize that the ice, like the next team wasn't getting at a different pool and they weren't going to heat it back up. So like the water just got colder and colder as each team went in. Like, it did start to seem dangerous, but also it just like it kind of brutalized the strategy of it, and I don't know. I feel like we've seen that before. Like,
yeah.
Now you have to sit in cold water for too long, and then the elimination challenge. I mean, okay, I continue to think that D is becoming overrated because she basically got lucky. Like, she got lucky on the like spinning the wheel to the right point that got her the pieces that were closer. Cause Ashley had to smash like every damn thing, every pot to get her actual game tiles. And then D also got help from Wes to order the seasons, which she had no idea how to do on her own.
Yeah, well, that would be really hard, right? If that was hard for me, and I watched those seasons, you know what I mean? So
if you've never
seen the show, that is rough.
I could have done it in like 3 minutes.
right, but that's what I'm saying. You have watched those seasons. She hasn't, you know.
I know. I'm not saying
through no fault of her own.
Totally, you're absolutely right. I'm not trying to criticize her in that respect. I'm just saying, like, she's winning eliminations And she's a champion from last year, but I don't feel like she's that good.
Right. Well, I don't know. Look, I don't know how skilled she is, but I think you also have to say that she's really had a fairly firm grasp on this game in terms of,
yeah,
you know, power and alliance. And that is in and of itself a skill. So while she has been fortunate, I also feel like she's really put herself in good position here. You know what
don't
I mean?
Don't you feel like it's the skill that is the least tangible? Like somehow she had, I feel like there's a level at which, and traditionally it's the super vets that have been good at this, but there's a level at which you can control the game just by convincing everyone that you're in control.
Yeah.
And I feel like somehow D has done that without actually a ton of, you know, social game skill.
Yeah.
But she has of people who like believe in her power, which makes it exist.
Yeah, and it's kind of, I mean, when you think about that, that's been built over really two seasons.
Yeah.
You know, and change. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it is. It is. You got to give her credit for that.
You know, and like, right, like she was, it was D and Ninja for a long time, and Ninja's not on this season, but I don't think Ninja could be doing this.
No,
you know what
no,
I mean?
No, Ninja's a mess.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why D has suddenly seized her powers. She's not being dragged down by a tiny ninja anymore.
All right. So that's the challenge. We should probably slide on to some of the we gotta talk. Did we talk Top Chef yet? We have not, correct?
No, we didn't.
Man, this was a you know, and look, obviously I'm fully in on Team Nene. Yeah. I enjoy her. I have her on the fantasy team. So you know where my allegiances lie, but I felt like this was an episode in which I don't think you're going to see a more bad beat all season in terms of getting eliminated for this. You got a double elimination where everybody made great food.
Yep.
And
the only
and
team
I don't...
that looked weak at the beginning, like before it started, was Malarkey and Leanne, and somehow they nailed it.
That one I felt coming. I'm like, the producers really want us to think that they're never getting
together. It was too obvious.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
But they obviously also did not work well together, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, except that they produced a fantastic product at
right.
the end.
Right.
I also think that, you know, the thing that was supposedly wrong with Nene's dish, Nene and Karen's dish, where it was the tomatoes.
Yeah.
And the issue with the tomato was it wasn't quite in the flavor profile, but also that it tasted so good that it was distracting from the other two flavors.
That's a bad
That's a tough way to go out. You know what I mean?
Did you watch Last Chance Kitchen?
I have not watched Last Chance Kitchen
dude.
Yet.
Dude. Yeah, you're killing me here. I almost think we should pause so you can watch Last Chance.
Really?
Well, I mean, it's just more bad beats, but, you know. It's a good one, too, because it's a double, and one of the people of the so now, you know, there are three people in Last Chance Kitchen, Lisa and Karen and Nene. One of them is back in the game, right? You saw the end of the episode, right?
That they were going to do it right then and there and put somebody back in, yeah.
Exactly. So one of them's back, but you don't know which one.
But I don't know which one. Oh, that's not good. That's not good.
No. And did you say Nene was on your fantasy team?
Yes. As is Lisa, by the way.
And that's it, right? Are you fully?
Yeah. And that's it, because Sasta was my other guy, so I'm out. If Karen's back in the game, I'm out. Which I kind of accepted anyway, as it is. I mean, I think it'd be tough for me, given the points being racked up by Kevin and Melissa.
Well, that's the other thing we have to talk about. I mean, I don't. So look, Gregory, who has been one of the best all the way through, killed it in the quick fire, and lifted up Stephanie in the main challenge, you know.
Yeah.
he might be my number one favorite right now.
Really? Because to me, I think there's separation.
I was going to say Kevin and Melissa are probably the top two. And them coming together is such a beautiful thing, because if we consider them the two favorites, they couldn't be more different chefs.
Yeah, for sure.
And they – what I thought was funny was their dish did not look that good.
Well, it's cabbage.
I know. I don't mean look tasty. I mean, it wasn't like a beautiful plate like we often get. It was kind of a...
I thought it was a really interesting plate.
It was, exactly. It was an interesting plate. But it wasn't like this immaculate, you know... I mean, for whatever I think about them as chefs and people, Malarkey and Leanne made a stunning, color-popping plate, right?
Yeah, agreed. That was one of the most visually beautiful plates of food all season, I thought.
Totally. And Kevin and Melissa had just like a thing that was interesting looking that they put in front of them. And everyone was like, I want more.
Yeah.
This is the best thing we've had today.
Well, you know, and as you said, they're very different chefs, but I think that dish was a sort of a symphony of their individual talents as well. You know what I mean? Like they.
Way to tie in the theme. That was really good.
Yeah. You know, they blended together so sort of seamlessly, and each sort of added something to the other's cooking, which was pretty impressive for the chefs. I think that at least in my mind, definitely been the two best so far. Although I think, you know, Gregory has cooked very well. I don't think you can count out Voltaggio either, because you really just have to be the best in the end.
Boy,
you know what I mean?
And I would say the same thing about Eric, but boy, did I think they were getting eliminated.
Yeah, I did too. And that's kind of what I mean, is that it seemed to me that their dish was the worst of the five.
Yeah. But I think they made the decision based more on conforming to the theme and hitting the flavor profiles that you were assigned than on who's tasted the best.
Yeah.
And that's always, those are always the tough ones. That's often where really great chefs get eliminated. But man, I was sad. I was sad.
Yeah, it was a tough one. It was a tough one. And then to get knocked out right before Restaurant Wars.
Mm.
Also tough.
How exciting. Restaurant Wars on deck.
Yeah. It kind of like when they were talking about, well, we're 10, and now there's going to be a double elimination. And the first thing that popped in my mind is, oh, here comes Restaurant Wars.
Yes. I specifically did not watch the scenes from next week, because I don't want any spoilers for Restaurant Wars.
I did watch the scenes from next week, and I'm glad I did, because it looks great.
I can't wait.
But I won't add any spoilers for you.
And by the way, we should mention, Melissa, in addition to winning the main challenge with Kevin, her tiny little cakes in the quickfire, which, by the way, the quickfires are always a challenge, but I thought this, with taking a bunch of non-bakers, the majority of whom have never used this kind of flour, and making them bake in like 40 minutes right now, is an incredibly challenging, like, that's a tough quick fire.
Yeah,
and
sure
you
is.
Could tell, because like Gregory, Nini, and Melissa were the three people who knew the flour, and they were the three people who were like the best dishes.
Yeah, well, and Nini's a pretty regular baker, so
yeah. Anyway.
All right, let's jump on there, because we do have a couple other shows we need to touch on.
Can we wrap up Better Call Saul?
Yeah, we can do that. I think, you know, tremendous season.
Yeah.
And I think we've discussed that to this point, so I won't belabor that. I think, you know, like a lot of other Breaking Bad seasons, the crescendo is the penultimate episode.
Absolutely.
And then this being the finale is driven a little bit more into setting up the terms of the next season's game, if you will.
But there is – I'm glad you said Breaking Bad seasons, because in my, other than the central characters, nothing at this point really separates Saul stylistically from Breaking Bad, do you think?
The show?
Yeah. Like, it has built and melded and turned with Saul Goodman into a Breaking Bad level situation, and like the show reflects that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the show definitely is much closer to Breaking Bad, I think, sort of by design, right?
Right. Well, I mean, I think you're building to it, right? But you're not really building to the beginning of Breaking Bad, even though time-wise you are. You're building to, like, the last season or two of Breaking Bad in terms of, like, fever pitch.
Yes. Yes. Although, right, it's, you know, it's sort of a – it's a different scale, right, than Heisenberg is, like, a full-on monster sort of by the end of it, right?
Well, except – right. Saul, I mean, Jimmy McGill is becoming Saul Goodman, which is a different thing than Heisenberg.
Right.
But as he becomes Saul Goodman, it's the pace and like fervor of the show is similar.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. We talked about how the sort of two halves of the show were kind of becoming one in these last few episodes. I do think ending, you know, the Kim and Saul portion of this journey kind of more focused on this plot to get Howard next season. It did seem like that was a surprise to me. It seemed like the show was sort of pointing towards she was going to be more active in Saul's future cartel business.
And maybe that's still true, or maybe that's the thing that's – I mean, that I think is what's cool about her – she's been building, right? She's been building her tolerance for crime, essentially.
Yes.
From cute little games to grifts to mild legal misconduct to outright legal misconduct to yelling at a cartel boss. And like the next stage in her evolution is attacking a former boss, because that's easy. But I don't know, is that the end, or is that the next step on the way to becoming involved in cartel business and getting killed? Is that the next step to realizing she's not up for this and bailing? You know what I mean? Like, there's still having Howard be the next step rather than cartel be the next step feels like it leaves a lot more possibility for Kim next season.
I suppose that's true. You know, and obviously the question of Kim is really the question that the, you know, show turns on, because we know what happens to so many of these other people.
See, and I think that's what – I think they know that, obviously.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's part of the Saul story. But, again, we know exactly where the Saul story is going, not just because we've seen Breaking Bad, but because they've shown us in this show. He's going to end up at a Cinnabon. Running for his life over and over
by again. Himself.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
So, you know, there's a lot still to answer in the final season, and that is the biggest takeaway of this season finale. Right?
Yeah, I think certainly the last couple of scenes, that's the takeaway, right? Is that we've, you know, here's the next game. This is what we've got to figure out, you know, over the course of the final episodes of the show. And this is one of those where there's another that Game of Thrones question, right? Of like, are they going to land the plane? Like, it feels like that mystery's been solved, right? We know they're going to land the plane. So, yeah. Can't wait. That show is... you know, it's just at the top of its game, and it's at the top of the TV game right now.
Yeah,
you know?
I really think it is. Although we did watch what I thought was another very good show this week.
Oh, really?
Yeah. No,
I wanted you. Where are we at on this? I want to hear which one of these you're talking about.
Well, I think there's really only one TV show per se we watched, which is Kenya Barris's Black AF, and I quite liked it. Which is a
really?
Little weird, almost, because
yeah, that's the, well. This is why I'm surprised.
Well, because it's. And keep in mind, I may not be the best person to make this analogy, but it feels to me like it's sort of mining the territory in the Venn diagram crossover between Blackish and Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yes, that I think that's the goal of the show.
Right. Neither of which are shows that I necessarily have watched much of, or I find them both funny. But I don't find either of them compelling to watch.
Mm.
And this, for whatever reason, I kind of do. I think part of it is Kenya Barris's character, to me, is much funnier than Larry David's character. And maybe it's because we don't... It's fresher. Like, I've seen obnoxious old white men. In fact, there's one almost everywhere I look. The unique sort of marriage of the character Kenya Barris's affluence and desire to show it, and you know, dramatic sort of proselytizing about the plight of his people is hilarious to me. And I think maybe it's because somehow his like misanthropism or whatever misanthropy is feels more justified than Larry David's. And it's because of slavery, as every single episode says. Like, did you notice the names of the episodes?
Oh, I sure did. Yes.
Like, I just everything about this to me is both funny and like. Just maybe hilariously poignant is the way to put it.
Okay, so I think we have a sort of the same grasp on the situation here in terms of what the show is trying to do, and I think I feel 180 degrees the other direction from you in almost everything you just said.
Wow, you don't like it at all.
It's not that I don't like it at all, but I do love Curb Your Enthusiasm, and I do find. The character of Larry David, if you will, to be, discomforting, but just tremendously watchable and hilarious. And I found the character of Kenya Barris, I'll put in air quotes, to be uncomfortable but insufferable.
Huh. Insufferable.
But I mean, not in a like. But yeah, I mean, I guess that's what I'm saying is that Larry David is also insufferable, but in a fun way. Huh. And I felt like Kenya Barris was insufferable, but not in a fun way, not in a watchable way.
How many did you watch?
I watched quite a few because this was a show that I felt like was the kind of show that I was, you know, like we've been talking about the last couple of weeks, when I've been looking for stuff that's been
fun.
A little more lightweight.
Uh-huh.
You know, I was like, ah. Well, I'll give this thing a shot. And look, it's not that I didn't find it enjoyable at times, but I always felt it to be less enjoyable a television experience than Blackish, which is like, you know, not a top shelf enjoyable television experience for me. You know, the character, Anthony Anderson's character on Blackish and Kenya Barris are obviously pretty similar in both their likes and many of their foibles, and I just feel like the Anthony Anderson fictionalized version is so much more interesting. I feel like Rashida Jones is a little bit wasted in this show.
Really? Rashida's good? I mean, I love her.
No, I think Rashida's great. I just think she's not involved enough.
In general.
What I mean?
All right.
Like the couple of episodes that did revolve a little bit more around her, I felt were the more interesting episodes of the show.
Huh.
So, this is one where I was like, I don't even know if I'm going to finish out this season.
Huh. All right. I feel sad.
I feel surprised. I was definitely when you were. I thought maybe this was going to be a thing where you were talking about Too Hot to Handle and how you turned around on it. That it was became an enjoyably trashy experience for you.
Well, I never said it wasn't, but
okay.
But no, I really thought Black AF was funny. I enjoyed it.
All right, well, let's get into Too Hot to Handle real quick then.
Wait,
if you don't mind.
What about Middle Ditch and Schwartz?
Oh, we can do that really fast. For me, anyway.
What does that mean?
I would say my take on it was, do you remember when we talked about doing this last episode?
I remember that we talked about doing this.
You had some reticence about taking on this show. And I got you to spell out your fears about it being about the difficulty of watching improv on TV. Uh-huh. And frankly, I took those really pretty lightly, to be honest. I wasn't really concerned about any of those stuff. And I'm here to say that you were right. Everything that you said turned out to be exactly true. I actually it didn't quite check my watch. I did that Netflix thing where I like was checking how much longer was left in the episode. Uh-huh. Yeah. And it turned out to only be 2 minutes. So, you know, I guess I got pretty close to the end, but I feel like that's pretty telling in terms of the entertainment value. Like, it just goes on too long. Just too long.
Yeah. Well, right. It's just and it's the sort of thing where you can tell they're good. Like you can clinically tell that these two guys are good at this thing that they're doing. But it doesn't have the sort of hit rate you need for on-screen entertainment. And just improv pretty much never will. There's like an impressive element to it and a this makes me smile element to it, but like it's never going to have the laughs.
Right. The joke rate isn't totally there. And there's just even these guys doing it at a high level, there's just a certain amount of flop sweat, you know what I mean, that is inherently a part of this process. And
although
not
I
all
think
that winning to watch on television. It's better in person, I feel like.
Totally. And I do think the flop sweat is part of, you know, Thomas Middleditch's whole shtick.
Sure, of course, yeah. But I also think that at some point it's hard when comedy is just trying that hard all the time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It just doesn't have the same ability to shift gears as scripted comedy does.
Exactly.
Yeah. That was my take. Not all that fun.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not bad, and I like both of those guys, and they're both good at what they're doing. It's just, it's a tough thing to have in a Netflix special.
Yep. But since it was their idea, I got to put that on them.
That's true.
At the end of the day. All right, so Too Hot to Handle. I think I gave a decent spiel about this last week that basically it's, I think it's the Love Island people, right? Otherwise, it is an incredibly savvy ripoff of the Love Island DNA.
They even have the same microphones.
Yeah, exactly.
they definitely
so what was your take
like
on
they
it?
Have the same wardrobe outfitters.
How many episodes did you watch, by the way?
I think we're through three or four.
Okay.
The new guy, Bryce, just came in.
Gotcha. All right. That's fair enough.
It's incredibly stupid and incredibly watchable. I mean, these are I think these people might be dumber than the Love Island people. Is that possible?
It is possible.
They are. I would say every one of these people is as stupid. Well, okay. The vast majority of these people are as stupid and sex crazed as the stupidest and sex crazed, stupidest and most sex crazed people on Love Island. Is that fair?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I would say that's fair.
So it's just they're so open about the fact that all they do is have sex all the time, and now they're not allowed to have sex, and then they are engaging in these like shenanigans and secret plans that of course are doomed because they're the biggest idiots I've ever seen in my life.
Right. And yet all of that is supremely watchable.
Oh yeah. And like it's a fun thing to have on in the background if you're like cooking or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And just laugh at these stupid people while you chop up some onions.
Yes.
It really totally watchable. And if you watched any Love Island, if you enjoyed Love is Blind, you know, this is probably for you.
And I don't think it's spoiling anything to say, you know, they do actually learn things along the way. I'm not saying they get smart or you'll ever think they're smart, but they do actually learn things between now and the end of the show.
I can't wait
for
that because they really haven't learned a damn thing so far.
That is correct. Not all of them learn things, I should say, too.
Sure, sure.
But yeah, there'll be some good highlights for you ahead. I'm excited for that.
I like it.
And that's it. You know, look, you're not going to watch this at any point and not be keenly aware that you're watching trash. But
right, it is definite trash.
Yeah, but if that's what you're looking for, it capably does the job.
Yep.
All right. I think that wraps it up, right? I think we got through everything. You ready to do homework?
We didn't talk at all about...
Oh, we didn't talk about Flying Coach.
Yes.
You know, I will listen to more of these. I got through the first one.
Uh-huh.
Because I think these are... You know, I just like hearing smart people and accomplished people talk, you know?
Yep.
Try to just sort of figure out how they... feel about things,
and I think they you'll get more and more of that as this goes on. I mean, I think that is the ultimate goal here, and certainly the second episode, which talks a lot about draft, gets a little more into some philosophical approaches to look, these are two champions, right? But I mean, champions in both of them are champions in multiple ways.
Yeah.
Carol has college and pro. Kerr has player and head coach. Like, these guys are two of the most successful people in sports history in terms of just winning. And they both have concrete philosophies, and they're both thoughtful about how they go about things. And so I think it's very interesting to listen to them talk.
Yeah. I think it was also interesting to hear about some of the things outside of their sport that they were interested in, too, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that was really the first episode. Like I said, the second episode was a lot about draft stuff, with the draft obviously in front of us at the point that it came out, and I'm not sure what will be next week, but I would strongly recommend it. If you're a podcast listener, which if you've gotten this far, I bet you are, it's called Flying Coach, and it's, you know, Warriors head coach Steve Kerr, Seahawks head coach Pete Carroll, who have a relationship that goes back a ways, which they explained to you in the first episode. It is a really interesting conversation, I thought.
Yeah. Also a thing I did not know. Yeah. So you'll learn some stuff, and it's a very digestible amount of podcast as well.
Totally. Less like 30 to 45 minutes.
Yeah. Once a week. So, you know, that's a consideration these days, although I guess people have more time for podcasts maybe than they used to. So.
Perhaps. And again, hopefully you're still listening like an hour and five some odd minutes into this one. So, you know, thank you. And please continue.
Yes,
and now
please,
it's time for homework.
Continues. Yes. If you'd like to continue with us to the next one, we are going to talk about Dispatches from Elsewhere, which we think is having its season finale. I've gotten this wrong four or five times.
I'm pretty sure it is. I'm pretty sure this is it.
There is an HBO movie airing tonight for the first time, although, you know, it's HBO, so get it when you want. It's called Bad Education.
It's not just regular ass TV.
It's right. Hugh Jackman and Allison Janney star in this.
And that's enough for us, so it should be enough for you.
Yeah, you know, it's about people who defrauded the school system.
And it's based on a true story, right?
It is based on a true story, yes, yeah. Of a Long Island school district. And then there's a new Mindy Kaling series on Netflix on Monday called Never Have I Ever, which is getting really good reviews so far. I think it's 100% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, yeah. 100% fresh.
So, yeah, we'll check that one out. And then Thursday night, in addition to Top Chef and The Challenge, which, of course, we'll discuss next week, along with two more episodes of The Last Dance. Thursday night, woo, got through all that. There's a Parks and Rec is coming back for a special episode that is being taped for coronavirus relief, which means it's, you know, being done in this modern style with not all of them in the same room. But it's written by Mike Shore.
Style.
Yes, this current,
you know,
ultra modern style.
This new artistic thing we're doing, where no one's in the same room with each other.
Right. Well, it's certainly going to make it look different than
it had been recorded
4 or 5 months ago. But from what I understand, the entire original cast is—I don't know about original, sorry, because obviously some people left the show. But the, you know, all the people that you want,
can't wait,
are participating. So, yeah, it's going to be tremendous.
I'm very excited about that, and more Top Chef and Challenge and Last Dance. It's a good time for media consumption. What can I say?
thank God we all have time.
Yeah. All right. Let's get to it. Bye bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The lights out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling, and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.